Hello, my name is Anna Beer. I'm visiting fellow at Kellogg College here in Oxford, and I'm going to be talking about John Milton. And my way in to Milton in 10 minutes is an impossible task, but my way in is going to be to share with you a few short extracts from one of Milton's fairly early poems, a poem called Lycidas. I'm just going to read the extracts, pause for a moment, and then talk about how they might connect and what they show about the very special qualities that Milton has as a writer. Now, the poem Lycidas, Milton wrote it in 1637, and it's in honour, it's an elegy for a friend and acquaintance from Cambridge who had died young, he'd been drowned. And so it's a poem, it's a lament for somebody whose life has been cut off early. And the particular pain of the poem, well, there are many different anguish, points of anguish in the poem, but one of the most important ones is that the man, Edward King, was a minister of the church, and the poem explores what it is not just for a young man to die early, but for a young man of the church to die. So to begin simply with the extracts. As the poem begins, there's a sort of incantation, and King is called Lycidas in the poem, and I think that's all you need to know for the first few lines. For Lycidas is dead, dead ere his prime, young Lycidas, and hath not left his peer. Who would not sing for Lycidas? So the poem begins with that kind of tone. Now, as you listen to the following few extracts I'm going to read, keep an ear out for words connected with singing, because even though the four little extracts I'm reading are very different, they touch on different topics, the idea of singing links them together. So listen out for that. I'll just read that one again, then I'm going to go straight into the other ones. For Lycidas is dead, dead ere his prime, young Lycidas, and hath not left his peer. Who would not sing for Lycidas? And then about 100 lines later, there's a passage about the clergy, the contemporary clergy in Milton's time in 1637, who are failing utterly in their duty to provide pastoral care for their flock, for their congregations. And it is these clergy who, when they list, only when they want to, when they list their lean and flashy songs, grate on their scrannel pipes of wretched straw, the hungry sheep look up and are not fed, but swollen with wind and the rank mist they draw, rot inwardly and foul contagion spread. And towards the end of the poem, which, as I said, is trying to understand how a young man's life could be cut so short, so tragically, there is a consolation. There's a vision of Edward King of Lycidas in heaven. There is heaven. There entertain him all the saints above, in solemn troops and sweet societies that sing, and singing in their glory move, and wipe the tears forever from his eyes. Now, Lycidas, the shepherds weep no more. That is nearly the end of the poem, the vision of Lycidas in heaven, singing sweet hymns. But in some of the most famous lines from English literature, the poem takes a sudden turn, and we find that the speaker is not Milton himself, as it were, but it is an uncouth swain. And I'll just read the closing lines of the poem with its very famous closing line. Thus sang the uncouth swain to the oaks and rills, while the still morn went out with sandals grey. He touched the tender stops of various quills with eager thought warbling his Doric lay. And now the sun had stretched out all the hills, and now was dropped into the western bay. At last he rose and twitched his mantle blue, tomorrow to fresh woods and pastures new. Now, I hope you'll have heard, apart from anything else, as I say, the way that Milton creates patterns with language. In this case, there are many patterns there, but one in particular is the different ideas of singing, failed singing, glorious singing, heavenly singing, the singing of the poet himself, what it means to sing. And it puts pressure on the reader, to me, exciting pressure, to try to connect those different understandings of a central term. But in the end, what draws me back again and again to Milton, and pretty much ever has done since I was forced, indeed forced, to study him at school, and I resisted for a good few many months, thank you Mrs. Foster of Sixth Form College for forcing me to keep going, is that Milton is not afraid of the big questions. And not only is he not afraid of the big questions, the ones that keep us awake at night, he has, for me, a fascinating approach to those questions. On the one hand, he tries to work out, as it were, how something can have happened. How, I mean, in the sense of the mechanics of it. If Eve ate the apple in the Garden of Eden and brought sin into the world, if we accept that, what were the events that led up to that event? Or when he's looking at the story of Samson from the Old Testament, Samson who pulls down the temple of the Philistines, destroying them, but also himself. Very bloody, terrible moment, one of many in the Old Testament. He wants to understand what brought Samson to that point. The Bible does not tell him. Milton supplies, as it were, the backstory, the mechanics. But on a perhaps a more fundamental, moral, ethical level, he also asks, how could these terrible things happen? And as a Christian, that question, of course, ties in with his understanding of God as the God of love. How can a loving God permit this kind of suffering? How can a loving God permit evil in the world? Now, today I've got only a small amount of time, so I can't talk about the political and even the domestic applications of this. How can God permit bad marriages? Something that preoccupies Milton a lot, partly because of personal experience. Politically, what is the best way to govern? What would God want us to have as a political system? And he tries to work out, why on earth are the English people welcoming back the monarchy that we still have now in 1660? And that gives a clue to another reason that I find Milton endlessly challenging and fascinating. His metaphysical questions are never abstracted from our lived reality. That, for me, is at the heart of Milton's work. I'm reminded of a quotation from a 20th century novelist, Penelope Fitzgerald, an elegant, wonderful novelist, in her novel The Gate of Angels. And she has a Cambridge don welcoming his students, and they're studying advanced sciences, physics. And the don says, "You have come to Cambridge to study the interdependence of matter and energy. Please remember that matter and energy are in no way something distinct from yourselves." And I think Milton is constantly trying to remind us that though we may want to place discussions about God and sin and evil and goodness and love in an abstract world, no, they matter here and now. Now, I want to return to Lycidas. Some people don't like the poem, and you can see why. If you scratch beneath the biographical surface, you find that Edward King wasn't a particularly close friend of Milton. So why this enormous edifice of grief to somebody he didn't really know very well? Is it all about performance? Another thing they don't like about it is that it is in many ways, perhaps because he wasn't that close to Edward King, a very self-absorbed poem. It's much more about Milton's own anxiety. What if I were to die tomorrow? He's still a fairly young man, he still has a great consciousness of his own gifts, and he still is frightened that he hasn't achieved his potential. So the poem, in a sense, is about his own fear of an early death. I read to you the consolation that the poem offers of singing in heaven, and that, of course, is a conventional consolation, and it is fairly hard won in that poem. We have various different consolations offered to the reader. All of them are put to one side. Some of them are described as a false surmise. It's what our frail thoughts, to use Milton's words, need, that we comfort ourselves in illusory ways. And the only true comfort for him within his Christian theology is that Lycidas, Edward King, is in heaven. So much for the consolation. Beautifully done. But there are two other aspects of Lycidas that confuse and trouble readers, even now. Now, the first you could glimpse in one of the extracts I read you earlier. I mentioned that it's a denunciation of the clergy, and it just comes intruding into the poem without any preamble at all. I'll just read a moment from something that I've written about this section. In the midst of the lament for Edward King, a startling voice, that of St. Peter, interrupts the poem, denouncing the churchmen of his time. They are the blind mouths who have betrayed their flock. The flock now rot inwardly and foul contagion spread. It's a powerful and I think enduring expression of the fear that the people of England were rotting inwardly. The psyche and the soul of the nation, as much as the body, were in perilous danger. And that is deeply characteristic of Milton. Almost every line that he writes as a mature poet is trying to speak to our inner selves, because only through reforming and the inner self, politically and in religious sense, will you get a nation of free citizens. That was his dream, but they had to be fully conscious, engaged, educated citizens, because then they would make the right choices. As I said, some people don't like the poem because it seems egotistical, self-absorbed. Others don't like it precisely because of this intrusion of politics. It's a rather embarrassing burst of political or religious zeal. Is it Milton showing his true radical colours, even as a fairly young man? We know he became an independent in religion. He became one of the most staunch Republicans. You can imagine he did not turn from his republicanism, even under threat of death. But as I mentioned earlier, what's certain is that intruding moment in the poem brings Milton's reader at the time, and in a sense us, to the present day. King's death matters. Edward King's death matters because it has deprived the church of a good minister, and the reason, and Milton reminds us why we need good church ministers. And the final little extract I read, with its very famous closing line, where we suddenly realise that the speaker is not Milton. And again, I'm going to turn to the book. It's rather puzzling because the authorial voice, the reader's expectation of the poem, are both disrupted. We're thinking this is a sincere lament from John Milton about his friend, but no. He's playing a game, which he often does, at least in his poetry, of now you see me, now you don't. If you want to read his prose, you get far more unmediated John Milton ranting. He's often profane, he's scurrilous, he's violent, occasionally completely impenetrable. But the energy is there, and it's very direct engagement with the reader. But in the poetry, a more subtle game is going on. Now, I'm not suggesting that Milton is a post-structuralist critical theorist, you know, 300 years before that kind of jargon was created, but he does demand that the reader does not read the poem as a direct confessional moment. He's asking us to attend to it as a work of art, even when it is written in the first person. And I speak this quite sort of acutely aware that I have attempted to write a biography of Milton. It is as if Milton is warning his readers not to plunder his poems for his life. He's warning his readers that there is no transparent relationship between the poem and the man. I want to close by talking about two pieces of, again, poetry that express for me something that I think is often overlooked in Milton, and often surprises people when they do finally come back to him, having been bullied into reading him at school. It is, for a writer who is often seen as difficult, baroque, complex, and he is all those things, yet some of his most powerful, his most inspirational moments are achieved through simplicity. I want to finish by talking about one of those moments, the remarkable sonnet, which is about his dead wife. Now, again, as a biographer, I don't know which wife it was. I do not care. It doesn't matter. This is a poem about grief again. And in contrast to Lycidas, which has that vision of Lycidas in heaven, of the sweet singing, there is nothing here. There are 13 lines of dense allusion to classical, to Christian, to references to the Old Testament. You can go and scurry away and look at all the footnotes and try to understand all the details. And yes, they enrich the poem. They enrich it enormously if you understand how Milton is playing off against those myths, those stories, those archetypes. But in the end, all of that is meaningless. It's an attempt to make sense of something that's happened to him. He's dreamt of his dead wife. And this is a blind man dreaming, a blind man seeing in his sleep. And the poem ends, the 14th line of the sonnet, and sonnets often turn at the end, provide a surprise to the reader. I waked, she fled, and day brought back my night. Those are all monosyllables. I waked, she fled, and day brought back my night. It's as if all the Baroque splendour, all the classical allusions, all the weight of religious reading, and my goodness, Milton was well read, scarily well read, are useless in the face of the consciousness, his consciousness that he won't see his wife. He cannot see his wife. That's one example of simplicity, but I simply want to end by reading the final lines of Paradise Lost. Because I think, despite that long, challenging, complex poem's recognition that sin and death and Satan are at work in the world now, in Milton's world, in this world, he's constantly reminding us, nevertheless, Paradise Lost refuses to be a despairing poem. It was created in time of great crisis. The fact that Milton wrote it at all, let alone published it, is a story in itself. But by the end of Paradise Lost, and the clue is in the title, Satan has triumphed, of course. But not only is there the extraordinary promise of redemption through the Son of God, who will prove above heroic, a new form of heroism, the offer of the Son of God to give his own life to redeem humanity. But for me, there is the equally striking, deeply moving and very human vision of Adam and Eve leaving Eden. This isn't an apocalyptic image, it isn't an image of complete despair. It's an image of companionship and even of hope. So I'll just end by reading those lines. Again, they work their magic through simplicity. Some natural tears they dropped, but wiped them soon. The world was all before them. Where to choose their place of rest and providence their guide? They, hand in hand, with wandering steps and slow, through Eden took their solitary way. And that's where Milton ends. That's where I'll end. Thank you.